So a group of scientists once approached God and said, "Listen, God, we've decided we don't need you anymore. These days we can clone people, transplant organs, and do all sorts of things that used to be considered miraculous." God replied, "So you don't need me, huh? How about we put things to the test? Why don't we have a competition to see who can make the best human being?" The scientists agreed as one of them bent down to grab a handful of dirt to start the process. "Whoa," says God, "what are you doing? You get your own dirt." You know, isn't it interesting that our very existence begs the question, how did we get here and why are we here? It's certainly something humankind has wondered of about for millennia. But what is it about us and our world that even causes us to wonder about our origin and purpose? Well, in part, I think something has to be wonderful to elicit wonder, and is the very complexity, order, vastness, and beauty that we see that causes us to seek an explanation. Well, over the past 2 weeks, I've presented a case for the existence of God by looking at the complexity and vastness of what we see, showing His intelligence and creative power to be the best explanation for it. That's not to say that there aren't other explanations for it, but I think it is the best explanation for it in terms of just logically looking at what is here, and certainly pointing to a great reasonableness to our faith as opposed to a blind faith that we would have. We have looked at cosmology and biology. Today, we consider issues in physiology and evolution and the fossil record. And you can take that down. Not quite yet, Kevin. We'll get to that. So if that piques your curiosity, that's good. But we don't want you focusing on that quite yet. So when you think about when Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species in 1859, he was not the first to explain the world from a naturalist point of view. When I talk about naturalism, that is an approach to the creation, or they would call it creation, they would talk to the approach to the physical world that is just about natural cause. It's something that dismisses the divine or any outside intervention to explain where we are. So he was not the first one to do that. But what Darwin provided was the mechanism, the procedure through which naturalism could explain the complexity that existed in the world. I don't think he explained it well, but it was at least a mechanism for that. So what Darwin proposed is that through a process of natural selection and the survival of the fittest, living creatures progressed from the simplest cells to complex organisms. That all living things had a common ancestor, and as benefits were gained by those ancestors, that caused them to survive better and reproduce more. So those benefits were propagated throughout populations to the point that bacteria became fish, fish became amphibians, amphibians became reptiles, and reptiles became birds and mammals. Now, as creationists, we do not need to set aside natural selection or the survival of the fittest completely, but we do recognize it doesn't have the ability to accomplish what evolutionists claim. And yet we recognize that adaptation is an essential part of what we observe in creation. That when we think about Darwin and his work on the Galapagos Islands as he studied finches there, I mean, what he observed there is something that is replicated around the world. I mean, what he found was the fact that these finches that had longer beaks could get through thorns and bristle better than other finches to get to food. And so as he continued to observe these finches over the years, he saw that finches with longer beaks started to be more numerous, that as they populated and ultimately bred, that function, that dynamic in terms of the length of their beak was extended, was grown because of the fact that it caused them to survive better. But basically that is a principle of adaptation, that is a principle of natural selection and or survival of the fittest that is not inconsistent with the creationist picture in terms of what the book of Genesis communicates. See, like I said, when we observe the world, two things that we observe is the capacity that the beings that God has created, what he gives them to adapt to their surroundings and ultimately improve function in order to survive in that surrounding. Another thing that we see in God's creation is a wide speciation. What I mean by that is there are numerous species around the world. And when you talk about just the number of species of dogs that we have, and where did all those dogs come from? Could we imagine there being a former dog that was a source of now all the species of dogs that we observe with the various character traits that might define them in their different species? I mean, you have bacteria that there's various species of just bacteria in terms of what we observe in creation. But again, that is reflective of the created order that I believe that God established. And now, Kevin, if you can bring up this slide. See, because basically what we don't agree with in terms of our creationist point of view is what is considered to be a particles to people aspect of evolution. And so basically the top picture is what Darwin and evolutionists point to in terms of all life starting. Well, actually, they even have to claim that life doesn't even start with a single organism. They have to concoct a reason how living things come out of non-living things. And really, that's what we spent the last 2 weeks talking about, is how impossible is that? How impossible is it for a living thing to come out of a non-living thing? But say you just made that leap, and now you've got this single cell, this one organism that starts the tree, that starts this progression, that through gradual processes, now all the complexity that we see in the world funnels down into one. Now, basically, the second picture is where evolutionists, to this writer that this the books that this comes from, how they misinterpret what creationism says about the world. And what this is alluded to is the garden of creation, of creation, and it's the caricature of creation presented by Dawkins. I mean, basically, a lot of the information I'm sharing today in the book that this is from, let me just explain a little bit about that, is the greatest hoax on earth. And basically, it's a refutation of a primary evolutionist, Richard Dawkins, where he talked about the greatest show on earth. And the greatest show on earth to Richard Dawkins was evolution and all the wonders that he sees that evolution accomplishes. And so basically, the writer of this book, and I'll get his name because I'm sure some of you care about that, others don't, is Jonathan Sefardi, that wrote The Greatest Hoax on Earth, where he just refutes all the different arguments that Dawkins offers in his book. And basically, as Dawkins talks about evolution that is present in adaptation, in speciation, and the fact that one mosquito changes to a point where other mosquitoes are developed from that mosquito that is a different species of mosquito than the original mosquito. But mosquitoes are still producing mosquitoes. Mosquitoes aren't coming from other organisms, and that's what particles to people evolution calls for. But when we think of what Genesis says about God's creation, it's really not this picture of every single species that we see on the earth today. It doesn't have to be part of God's creation in Genesis 1. And even more so, it doesn't have to be on the Ark of Noah. That what the Bible refers to in the book of Genesis and the Noah account is that God made things after their kind. And he gave the capacity within the things that he created in their kinds to propagate themselves according to their kinds. Now, a mistake or a misunderstanding was created when Jerome was translating in the Latin Vulgate the words in Genesis 1, and he used the Latin word for species in talking about the kind. But basically, that is not a good translation of the Hebrew word that is there that is more general than a species. And we don't have to pigeonhole in terms of what God created in every single species. Like, the only way that a species could come about is that God created it on the 6 days of creation, and that it was there present on the ark. Rather, if you lift the scroll the picture up, if you can do that, hopefully. Okay, so really what creationism points to is this orchard of creation, where basically what you have is you have God creating these kinds, but in these kinds, there is the genetic information there for them to have other kinds come from them, other species come from them. And again, if you don't see that in creation, you would at least have to understand when it comes to the number of species we have on the earth today, 4,000 different species of one kind of fish. The fish is a bad example because they don't have to be in the ark. They can swim in the ocean. But basically, you have just great speciation in terms of just the various species. So what this person is describing, and what I think is a more accurate picture, is if you imagine that God, in making these kinds, is he makes a wolf-like, dog-like creature. Like, we know, again, the various species of dogs that we observe. We know the various species of cattle that there are, or buffalo that come from that cattle. So just imagine that there's a certain kind that God makes that is wolf-like, dog-like, and then in the propagation of that dog-like creature, other dog-like creatures come, to the extent that as the dogs are propagating amongst themselves, a certain species gets far enough away in terms of the qualities that it has and its ability to replicate with a former generation. Okay, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. There is actually a mosquito in the tunnels of the London subway system that basically, this mosquito is unique in the fact that it cannot mate with other mosquitoes to make other mosquitoes. I mean, that is how species are defined, that when you can mate successfully, not only just in terms of sexual reproduction, but any reproduction, that you are able to create something else from that action of propagation in terms of another species coming from that relationship or that combination. So what you have is these mosquitoes in the London tube that, again, they're a unique species because they can't relate to other mosquitoes to create mosquitoes. But still, in their morphology, in terms of what you observe, what created those mosquitoes came from mosquitoes. They didn't come from flies, or they didn't come from the ooh goo goo or the, you know, pond that's in the bottom of the subway and all these cells came about and created. No, that you can connect it to former generations of mosquitoes, but in speciation, the way that it works, again, it's more like this orchard where God creates different kinds, and then those kinds replicate, and then different species form from that. See, to me, what that does is it honors the creation account, but it also honors what we observe in creation. It's what we observe in the world in terms of, again, the ability that organisms have to adapt, the great speciation that we have in terms of that. What I would also ask you is, what reflects God's glory more? What reveals his character more in terms of him producing everything that we observe, that whatever adult species would be required to explain the speciation that we have today, if he created all of those, and so everything has to come directly from his hand, that certainly would reveal God's power. It would reveal his ingenuity and his creativity. But isn't it a greater expression of that to say that I'm going to create a kind with all the genetic information that would be necessary for another kind of organism that's represented by this first step in whatever that kind would be? And then when we talk about what is propagated, what comes from and the interaction of organisms create other organisms, that there's a participation that we have in God's creation. See, the reason why you can have a baby and say, oh, he's got your eyes, oh, she's got your nose, so on and so forth, is that you have cooperated with God. God has given you a capacity within yourself to make a human being that, you know, we don't find the same type of adaptiveness in human beings because I think we are so advanced in terms of the complexity of us that it's impossible in terms of the adaptation we might see in smaller organisms or other parts of the world. But it's still it's still reflective of what I'm talking about God welcoming his creation to join with him in creating. And the fact that now things that are created are a combination of mother and father, male and female, coming together to create a next generation. But there are three things that we notice that we find in adaptation. Again, if I have lost you in any of what I've said thus far, the two main points is when we talk about a creationist model, we have to recognize that adaptation is a reality in our world. The second thing we have to recognize is that there are a lot of species in the world that aren't explained by God creating every single species that exists. But this is a model, this is a way to understand what we observe in the world that's consistent with the creation account in terms of God making kinds and then those kinds participating with God in terms of what is then created and what is then established in the world. So those are the two things that, again, we can't ignore. You can't escape that in terms of what you observe in the world, but I believe that God, that is part of God's plan as opposed to being opposed to God's plan. And let me say this, that oftentimes the thing that drives that is natural selection and is survival of the fittest. But in no way is it this particles to people evolution that you're starting from nothing, it's one organism, one cell that leads to everything else. That's so not what I'm talking about, but that's not to say that elements of natural selection, elements of survival of the fittest do exist in our world. But three things you find in adaptation. That one, it doesn't introduce new genetic information. That whenever you haven't, when they investigate and look at adaptations that happen, it's never caused by new genetic information. It's just a realignment of the information that is present in the organization. I mean, in the organism, rather. So it's not new information. It's just a reorganization of that information. More often than not, adaption breaks things more than it builds things. Because it's easier to break things than it is to build them, as in a loss of function that brings a survival benefit. You know, Michael Behe, the guy that wrote this Darwin's Black Box that we looked at last week, in terms of irreducible complexity, he wrote another book about the edge of evolution. And what he talks about in that book is he basically did a lot of studying about the malaria disease, the malaria virus, and how that is the most destructive virus the world has ever seen. And as the world has confronted ways to address the malaria bacteria, because there is an inoculation you can get for it, what they have found is that very quickly after they would introduce something to address malaria, malaria would change to be able to go around that antibiotic. And I can't remember what the antibiotic was that is the most successful. I know it begins with a CH, but you may know better than me. But what Behe looked at when he looked at this is he said, well, a couple of things. One is that for all those other antibiotics that came about, it required the malaria bug to just make one mutation. One mutation that oftentimes stops something, like it doesn't take in like energy or nutrients, so therefore it doesn't take in the antibiotic, or something that causes it to adapt to the presence of that antibiotic in a body that it's trying to infest. But when it came to this other vaccination that they developed, again, I can't remember what it is, that what he found was that the reason why that was successful is that it required the malaria bug to come up with two mutations. So what Behe's argument is in this book is that for the malaria organism, that virus or that infection that is simple in its dynamics, for it to generate two mutations, for it to beat this antibiotic that is introduced that kills it, it's very difficult for it to do that. So as he then extrapolates from that and says, well, just think about how many mutations or how many adaptations would happen for higher-celled organisms or multi-celled organisms or tissues or organs or the functions that we see in the body. And his point really is that it just can't happen, that whatever particles to people evolution calls for in terms of the various adaptations that would be required for to go from a single-cell organism now to everything, it just isn't possible. He also brings up the fact that sickle cell anemia is a benefit in fighting malaria. That basically if you go into areas of the world where malaria is prevalent, you will find people that have sickle cell anemia fighting against that malaria. Now this is an example of how a loss of information or bad mutation, bad adaptation actually brings survival benefit. Like, you'll find people in primarily African countries that have sickle cell anemia, and they're not getting malaria. So other people are dying from malaria. People with sickle cell anemia are not dying from malaria. And so you might find more people with sickle cell anemia in a community affected by malaria. But the point is, when it comes to adaptation, is that a good thing? I mean, outside of being in a scenario where there's malaria, do you want sickle cell anemia? Of course you don't, because it's something breaking down. And just so you know, that is the nature of adaptation. When you observe adaptation, again, the first point was there's never new information that's presented. And secondly, it oftentimes breaks things rather than builds things. And the third thing is it never leads to an organism becoming a different kind of organism. For instance, experiments on fruit flies causes a mutation to occur where additional legs grow out of its head, but they're still fruit fly legs. It's not another kind of leg. Again, these mosquitoes, they develop whatever it takes to live in the London Tube, but again, they've come from other mosquitoes. You have fish that live in caves that develop an ability to negotiate through the darkness of the cave, but it's effectively them losing sight. That if you took that fish and put it in a regular ocean, it would die because it wouldn't be able to escape predators because it couldn't adapt to light. And so that's, again, the nature of adaptation. But again, it's still fish becoming fish, mosquitoes becoming mosquitoes, so on and so forth. And in terms of the type of genetics found in those kinds, they did an experiment and they mated a wolf and a large poodle, if you can imagine that. And basically the first generation of pups that came from that meeting is that basically the pups were fairly mixed. That you would look at a pup and, boy, you could see wolf-like qualities, you could see poodle-like qualities in that pup. But then when they interbred those pups together, what they found is you had some pups that were strictly wolf-like. It had the aggressive tendencies, it had the markings of a wolf, everything that you would expect a wolf cub to look like or a wolf pup to look like. And then you'd have others that are strictly poodle pups. Again, this is coming from the interbreeding of that first generation into the second generation, and this is all to show that all the genetic information that was necessary for that second generation to happen was already in the first generation that came from that interaction. And so again, we're not talking about new information. And like I said, this is radically different from the particles to people evolution. See, basically, that type of evolution requires new information to be produced. It has to move from non-living material to living material, from single-cell organism to multi-celled organism, to complex systems and tissue and functions. It requires movement from one type of organism to another type of organism. It requires intermediary forms that have a little bit of one and a little bit of the other in terms of not, and I'm not talking about this dog has a little bit of poodle and a little bit of wolf. I'm talking about this reptile has a little bit of reptile and a little bit of bird. Intermediary forms like that. Darwin himself said that if my theory is correct, then, well, particularly he was referencing the fossil record because we don't observe it in our world today. He imagined the fossil record being filled with intermediary organisms that reflect his gradual progressive way of moving from one organism, one single cell organism, to the complexity, and it just doesn't happen. And so that's why, you know, what I'm saying in terms of God creating the kinds and then things adapting from there, but all consistent with what God has established in his creation. Now, one of the strongest evidences, again, that evolutionists point to, we don't think that it's good evidence, but the evidence they point to is said to be homology, or common features between organisms. I mean, you've seen this probably in your biology textbooks, or physiology or anatomy textbooks as you were going through high school, and you see the bird wing, and then it's compared to a human hand, and like certain functions or certain elements or certain bone structure is consistent in terms of a human hand and other things. And that was part of what Darwin observed or thought about that said, well, wait a minute, if we have a wing that looks like a hand, and it seems like they develop from the same place, well, then doesn't it make sense that we all came from the same organism? That again, all through this mutation and adaptation, organism became different organisms? And so basically, what we find when you look at science, when you look at genetics, is that it's not the case. In fact, the opposite is actually true. As one scientist wrote, the fact is that correspondence between homologous structures cannot be pressed back to similarity of position of the cells in the embryo or the parts of the egg out of which the structures are ultimately composed or of development mechanisms by which they are formed. More recently, a developmental biologist pointed out that it is the rule rather than the exception that homologous structures form from distinctly dissimilar initial states. Another author wrote this, the lack of correspondence between homology and developmental pathways is true not only in general, but also in particular case of vertebrate limbs. The classic example of this problem are salamanders. In most vertebrate limbs, development of the digits proceeds from posterior to anterior, that is, in tail-to-head direction. This actually describes frogs, but their fellow amphibian salamanders do it differently. In salamanders, development of the digits proceeds in the opposite direction from head to tail. From head to tail, the difference is so striking that some biologists have argued that the evolutionary history of salamanders must have been different from all other vertebrates, including frogs. And then lastly, the same author said, because homology implies community of descent from a common ancestor, it might be thought that genetics would provide the key to the problem of homology. This is where the worst shock of all has been encountered. Because characters controlled by identical genes are not necessarily homologous, and homologous structures need not be controlled by identical genes. You understood that completely, didn't you? Now, I know you didn't, but I'm going to explain what that was all saying. See, basically, if you have a commonality of structure in terms of what you observe in terms of the function of a dynamic in a wing or an arm or a fin or whatever you might observe in the actual body of an organism, of a creature, you would expect, if that came from a common descent, I mean a common ancestor, that it descended from a common place, that the pathway and the genes and the way that would be developed would be the same, right? In other words, if evolution figured it out, that this is how you get a reptile arm to become a bird arm, well, won't the genes and the genetics and the process that develops that remain consistent? You would think that, right? So basically what they've observed, and when they observe the genes and the way they function, it's not the case that you'll have the same kind of genes creating different kind of functions, and you'll have different kind of functions being explained by different kind of genes. And so whatever you might have been convinced of in your life, or whatever evolutionists might point to in terms of homology, it's not backed up by science. It's not, see, whatever you might observe in a commonality, doesn't a commonality also point to a creator? I mean, do you realize that, you know, for the most part, atoms are all the same in terms of their structure? That electrons always have the same negative charge, protons always have the same positive charge. Again, there's more protons in certain atoms than others. You know, you have certain kinds of tissues that you might have digestive tissue in one animal that's like digestive tissue in another animal. And so to me, that is God showing the sign of his creation that, you know, this is what works. Then when you're talking about muscle tissue, why do I need to create different muscle tissue for a human and for a dog if that's what good muscle tissue is? And so therefore, there's a commonality that we observe in the function of things, but then when you look behind it and see that the pathway that develops that function, it's not the same. And so that's God saying, you know something, here's my handiwork. You think because you observe a muscle here that's like a muscle there, and you think, oh, look at this. This is a proof that they developed from a common ancestor. Oh, yeah, look at how it developed in this organism. And the genes and the chemistry that allowed it to develop in this organism isn't the same as over here. So, again, a mark far more of creation than it is, well, it's no mark of evolution in terms of what is really happening behind the scenes. So, let's move on from that to the fossil problem. One of the greatest problems for evolutionists is the fossil record. Darwin himself said that if his theory were true, then intermediary forms would have to be present, and there is no evidence of that. You know, and not only do we not see that in the fossil record, it's really not even our experience now. See, what I think of, And I'm not sure how accurate it is even for me to think this way, that if you have this one cell that is starting this process of now having this tree go, well then, wouldn't you have another cell that's doing the same thing? And so you still have these evolutionary trees that are going. Or say, for instance, you know, there's some process where a monkey becomes a man. And so therefore, don't you think that whenever that starts, whenever the monkey starts developing human-like tendencies and so on and so forth, say it takes a million years for that to happen. Well, if one monkey starts at a million years, then maybe 10,000 years later, another monkey starts, or let's say a week later, because that's more, or a few years later. My point being, why don't we see it today? Why don't we go in the woods or in the jungles of Africa and see a monkey that's, boy, you kind of look like man. You're like walking up straighter, and you're, you know, beginning to communicate with language, and you're doing all the things that are the higher functions that differentiate a human from an ape. But so not only do we not see the intermediary organisms in the fossil record, we don't even see it in our experience. And so why, if this is something that's supposed to define evolution, make it clear that it exists here, why don't we observe that in our life? But again, it doesn't happen in the fossil record either. In the words of Stephen Jay Gould, an evolutionist, the history of most fossil species includes two features particularly inconsistent with gradualism. Two features particularly inconsistent with gradualism. In other words, inconsistent with evolution. The first principle is stasis. Most species, again, when it comes to the fossil record, most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. So in other words, you see a species come in the fossil record, you see its development, you see the different structures that it has, and guess what? There's no directional change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking pretty much the same as when they disappear. Morphological change is usually limited and directionless. Okay, so limited and directionless, don't forget that. And then the second thing that the fossil record is characterized by is sudden appearances. In any local area, a species does not arise gradually by the steady transformation of its ancestors. It appears all at once and fully formed. And you know something? This is exactly what Darwinism doesn't need. That what Darwinism would need, what evolutionism, what this particles of people evolution would require, is all these intermediary forms that would be in the fossil record. And there's none. One paleontologist wrote a book about the fossil record, and someone wrote him and said, boy, could you give me a picture in the fossil record of an intermediary form? And he says, writes back to the writer and says, you know something, I understand why you'd be confused about that, but I don't have one. So let me let the cat out of the bag, I'm paraphrasing here, that I do not know of any intermediary form that exists in life or in the fossil record, or else I would have shown it to you. And so that's what we observe. Another mystery in the fossil record is the Cambrian explosion. The term explosion refers to the fact that fossils of all major groups, the phyla, of animals appear in what is called the Cambrian period. Furthermore, no new phyla have appeared since then. Dawkins himself writes, The Cambrian shows us a substantial number of major animal phyla already in advanced state of evolution. The very first time they appear, it is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Okay, so why are you defending evolution then? If the primary thing you would point to, or one of the primary things, see, what I'm trying to do here for you is on various lines of argument, science, building a united case that, again, even though there might be some explanations that are different, well, certainly there are explanations that are different, but as you confront those explanations that may define certain points differently, when you take it all together, when you take the arguments that come from cosmology, from biology, and physiology, and put them together, the mark of God is unmistakably on it in terms of his intelligence and his creativity and his power. See, there are some things that evolution cannot explain. That when we think about what is essential to being a human being, to being a person, evolution cannot explain. Why do we have language? Why do we have language that is so developed in terms of its expression? Why do we have love and relationship? I mean, why do we have beauty? Why are we creative? Like, how does your creativity, you know, you're an artist type, you go to sleep when I talk about science. Your head starts to spin, my head starts to spin. You know, but you like drawing pictures and, you know, taking pictures or whatever. How does that help you survive? Oh, you know something? You like beauty, so therefore you're going to survive better and reproduce more. What? I mean, in other words, in order for something to work in this particles to people evolution, It has to help you survive, and it has to help you replicate. Because there's no way for you to pass on whatever benefit you have onto the next generation. So why do we care about beauty? There are actually 500 children, deaf children in Nicaragua that developed their own language. It was a language that was different from American Sign Language, but they developed high-level means of language and communication amongst themselves, where they had nouns, they had verbs, they had direct objects, they had causality. And so this was brought up in the case to show that language is an inherent part of being human. But where does it come from? Why would we have that? See, if we're talking about being able to communicate simply about survival, pass the salt, kill the animal, go get some groceries, you know, whatever we would communicate in terms, it's very basic in terms of what would be there. But when we think about the language that we have, when we think about the language that is different and the intellect that is different in a human child compared to an ape or a chimpanzee, it doesn't even compare. I mean, I haven't even gotten to, and I, you know, maybe I'll do it in the summer as a topic. We haven't even gotten to just the ridiculous idea that human beings came from monkeys, because there is such a gap between what exists in a human being. See, we're pretty amazed that of other mammals, there are some mammals that are pretty smart in terms of what you can train them to do: jump high, get a fish. You know, sign language for, but basically when it comes to chimpanzees, they can't think in terms of causality. They can't think in terms of cause and effect. Like when you think about, like they actually did a test on children where they talked about there's a certain object, a person comes in and puts an object in the room, and then they leave and someone else comes in and takes the object and puts it someplace else. A 3-year-old child cannot describe what happened. They cannot put themselves into a situation and understand the reason why the first person comes back and looks for the object in the same place, and it's not going to be there. And so the only way that they can find it is if the other person helps them know where they put it. They cannot make that connection. But a 5-year-old can. Like there's a development between 3 and 5 where a child is able to look beyond themselves into the context of someone else, into the context of another environment, and understand what's going on. Chimpanzee can't do that. A chimpanzee has never asked a question. And a monkey has never rationalized, well, wait a minute, if this has happened, then, well, what do you do with this? You know, we have a dynamic with our grandson Carter when he was, probably this was a year and even longer, he would come to us and he'd say, "Oopa, I have a question." And I don't know why it was that I said, well, Carter, is that a question or a statement? He says, "No, I think it's a question." And says, I want to play with you. No, Carter, that's not a question, that's a statement. And for the longest time, we're talking about this, and you know, he was actually in a store, And I think a salesperson said to him, "Well, can I ask you a question?" And Carter responds, "Well, is it a question or a statement?" But in his little mind, he was eventually able to differentiate. No, a question is, can I have something? And a statement is about me defining the world or expressing an opinion about the world. But a chimp can't do that in terms of the logic that is involved in that. And when we talk about morality, we talk about the fact that the dynamic of self-sacrifice. Why would someone run into a building that is burning and save someone else? How does that help that guy survive? You know, if we were dependent on the survival of the fittest and there was a self-sacrificing dynamic in humankind, well, all the good people would be dying because they'd be sacrificing themselves for other people. And so whatever dynamic there would be in self-sacrifice wouldn't continue because it's an inherent part of the image of God in us. It's an inherent part of what makes us wonderfully and beautifully made, that the only explanation for that, when we talk about all the things we've talked about in terms of adaptation and how God has used that to
to really reveal his glory on this earth in terms of his creativity and all the things that he purposed, and by virtue of purposing them, he put the genetic material in those original organisms so no new information is presented, because God thought of it from the beginning, but wanted us to participate with him, all creation participating with him, and then establishing what would be on the world, and in the world. But let's bow and let's pray. Father, we just do come before you and just thank you for all the ways that you have displayed your wonder in creation. Father, I just pray that even though much of this is a little confusing and it's a lot in terms of information, just all that it speaks to of your work and what you have done, and whatever defenses or arguments that come from evolution that explain things in a different way, and how science can be used to reveal that that's just not the case, that we just would be more affirmed in our faith, more affirmed in the reality of your being. Like I said, that being more humble in terms of a great God that has established so much wonder and so much creativity and so much intelligence in terms of what we observe and what we're surrounded by, that just should cause us to be in awe. We are so familiar with so many things that our bodies can do, and what privilege we have to participate with you in creation and our creativity and our the beauty we pursue and the beauty that we foster. Father, so much that points to your glory, and it would only be because of you that we have those things. Nothing starts with us. It always starts with you, and we're just grateful that your creation and your word defines that for us. Father, for anyone here that doesn't know Jesus in a personal way, when we think about just the direction that faith in God, faith in a creator would bring us to in terms of relationship and that God pursuing us and providing a means to come to you, Father, that is all about Jesus, and that is all about why he came to this earth, to reveal God, to die on a cross so that we could be forgiven. A lot of that we'll cover next week, but I just pray for anyone here that may be in a process not only of believing in God, but then believing in a personal God and believing in his son Jesus. I just pray for them in the process that they're in and in the drawing that you're doing and accomplishing in their hearts, that you would bring that to fruition, that they would participate with you in terms of what you're trying to foster in their hearts. And so, Father, we lift all this before you in the matchless name of your son Jesus. Amen.